A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display? I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 215. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion about Fireball XL5. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, we're back in the world of Gerry Anderson and Super Marination and his 1962 black and white series Fireball XL5. 39 episodes, 25 minutes each, and they feature the adventures of the remarkable crew of a remarkable rocket ship, the titular Fireball XL5 itself.
Yes, and we are in the world of early 1960s children's TV, with all of that means, with the style they were doing things then, and quite an early style for the Gerry Anderson puppet systems, but some neat things happening there as well, for sure. So the format of the episodes, we start with an opening sequence that we see every time with Steve Zodiac and Venus on their hover bikes boarding Fireball XL5 and this fairly impressive launch sequence of the rocket going down this horizontal railway that scoops up and shoots it up into the air on an angle where it takes off into space. And the Fireball XL5 is usually sent into action by Commander Zero of the World Space Patrol, often to investigate another ship that's in trouble, a mysterious planet, or something that is a threat to Earth.
Yes, that's right. We've got alien races that will threaten Earth, and some of them are quite fantastic, particularly the fishmen and the walking plants. We've also got strange cosmic phenomena like magnetic planets and other bits and pieces that will lure the ship into danger. And of course, we've got for the 1960s some secret plots and underhand goings on. And as you say, we've got a little bit of reused footage, particularly the launch sequence, particularly Steve and Venus on their hover bikes. And once at their destination, Fireball XL5 does this remarkable thing, which is to detach the nose cone into Fireball Junior so they can land on a planet and then again use these remarkable hover bikes to get around.
Yes, and of course the hover bikes conveniently avoid the problem of having the puppets walk, which they could never do very well. But we have this Gerry Anderson style of all these spectacular vehicles with hover bikes and thruster backpacks that they use in space, and of course the XL5 itself with the detachable nose cone that acts as a landing craft, which does fit in with the real 1960s space technology of the capsule moving away from the rocket and the separate landing crafts and so on. There are lots of themes familiar to the 1960s space exploration, the interest in astronauts as sort of popular heroes, of course spying and subterfuge comes in from time to time, we get pirates, we get a dream sequence at one point, all of these little things that we would see in the Gerry Anderson shows quite frequently, as well as other 60s series.
And there's some Cold War conspiracy stuff thrown in there as well, I suppose, typically for 60s shows. And we should also mention that unlike, you know, the Russian and American space programs at the time, which were only trying to get to the moon. Farbod XL5 seemingly has no problems at all in traveling to other solar systems to reach faraway planets. It does travel at remarkable speeds, apparently, even as we've said in one episode, where it manages to exceed the speed of light in even more remarkable fashion. And it's all down to the fictional Newtomic reactor, which powers it.
Yes, and interestingly enough, they go on individual missions, always leaving from Earth and coming back to Earth. It doesn't use the style that would soon become much more popular of the sort of ongoing voyage where the spaceship and crew stay out in space for a long period of time, going from one place to another to another. This was very much that idea that they would leave Earth, do whatever was required in the given episode, and come back home and land the entire spacecraft.
So let's talk a little bit about Farbod XL5 in relation to Gerry Anderson's other shows from the 60s. I suppose the notable difference to the shows we've looked at so far is that this one is earlier and therefore in black and white, filmed in black and white. So that's what we can see on the DVDs, apart from this one episode, A Day in the Life of a Space General, which has been colorized. So, of course, we do have the slight problems of black and white. We've got the larger head puppets, which you'll be familiar with from Stingray and Thunderbirds, if you've seen those. And as we said in our last episode, they had to have these large heads in order to accommodate the motors inside that operated the eyes and the mouth. Of course, by the time they got to Captain Scarlet, they'd moved on so that the technology had allowed that to be miniaturized and they could have a more realistic scale puppet.
Yes, by the time Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons came around, they were able to put those electronics into the chest of the puppet rather than the head, which allowed for more realistic proportions. But Gerry Anderson and his team were very progressive in terms of trying to improve the technology that they were working with. And the technology and the quality of the puppets really vastly improved over the years. And this is still quite early, so they're not quite as sophisticated and capable as they would be later, certainly in Thunderbirds. And they're also still shooting in black and white, which they were for the last time. After this, they would move to color.
And I did wonder about the black and white, whether the puppets' wires or strings were more visible than in the color shows, or whether the technology had moved on for the color shows in terms of filming. Certainly in black and white, I seem to notice that more often.
Yes, I don't know. At times, in some of the effect scenes with the vehicles and the like, with the model work, I quite like the look of black and white in this. But it definitely is sort of quite early work for them, and they do improve on their techniques later on. We already had in this one some use of real hands in close-ups. When a character had to operate a switch or do something that was a detailed manual sort of thing, there would be a close-up of the character's hands and we would see an actor's hands really doing something. So that was the sort of thing that they used in this. And I think they used it more and did slightly more sophisticated and complex things with their hand actors later on, but they were already doing that here, and it was already quite effective, I think.
Yes, classic Super Mario Nation, where it switches to a human hand to actually do the technical stuff and then switches back to the puppets. Yeah, very good stuff.
Yeah, in this case, I think they were wearing gloves to sort of match the look of the puppets, where later on, I think if the puppets' hands were bare, then the actors' hands would be bare as well. So, you know, they just sort of tweak those kinds of things as they go. This had the shorter episodes, you know, roughly 25-minute episodes, rather than the longer ones that they went to that were 45, 50 minutes for Thunderbirds. I think the short episodes work quite well. It's sort of punchier for the kinds of stories that they're showing. But of course, being at the time it was in the early 60s, this was before Doctor Who had been broadcast. The stories and the humor were more on the childish side than they would be later, and sort of fit within the sort of children's TV styles of the fairly simple stories and, you know, exaggerated character voices that rather than realistic ones and so on.
Yes, that's right. And of course, we're looking back on a children's show from over 50 years ago, and we're perhaps looking back on it now with our adult eyes and seeing things that perhaps an early 60s child wouldn't have seen. But I did note that from time to time there were some sort of sexual and racial stereotyping, which I suppose is of that time period. So we know that Sylvia Anderson intended Dr. Venus to be a very progressive modern woman, but at times she does seem more a typical damsel in distress. She's often in trouble and needing rescuing. And we know from several episodes that she's in love with Steve Zodiac and he doesn't seem to notice this at all. So it's slightly awkward with the way Dr. Venus is portrayed, I think, Brian.
Yes, it definitely is of its time. And you see that in the portrayal of a number of the characters, and the scientist character is certainly one of them, but especially with Venus, it really seemed like they were trying to do something progressive with that character, but it really did have its limits.
Yes, and I mean, you know, as we say, she at times she's a very competent doctor treating some weird and wonderful space diseases. So there is that to it.
Yes, absolutely.
I also, again, you know, perhaps noticing things now that I wouldn't have noticed at the time, but I did think that occasionally some of the alien races did seem to have characteristics that would mark them out from sort of Asian races or Russian races in terms of voices, in terms of the facial designs. And I wondered whether that just reflected the sort of paranoia of the time, that Cold War era, when there was a lot of this stuff about, I suppose, a lot of distrust, and it spilled over into popular culture.
Yes, that may be the case. I found that those things were not nearly as bothersome to me as the Asian stereotypes in Thunderbirds were, where you had not aliens that had familiar characteristics, but you actually had some Asian characters in there that were not portrayed in a very good way. So it was nice that we at least didn't have that in here, but it definitely has some things that are of its time that you would not see in later programs.
Okay, so as we say, it is of the early 60s, it is black and white, it is perhaps a transitional show for Gerry Anderson between the early stuff on Four Feather Falls and Supercar to the later sort of runaway successes of Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet, Joe 90. But it's an interesting show. And of course, as we mentioned before, it did have several spin-offs, I think, Brian.
Yes, it actually had a number of things going out into other media. It was probably the first big merchandising hit for Century 21 Films, where they had toys based on Fireball XL5, they had model kits, they had things like lunchboxes, and of course they had puppets. As well, they also had the comic books. In fact, The Adventures of Fireball XL5 appeared in TV Comic before the first episode of the TV series aired, which is quite unusual indeed.
Yes, there are some fantastic Fireball XL5 comics. We touched on them when we discussed Gerry Anderson comics on a previous episode. They started, as you say, in that well-known TV comic, which ran sort of comic strips about all popular TV shows of the time. And then, of course, it would move into Anderson's own TV Century 21 comic from, where it actually ran from 1965 till 1970, so well after the show had finished airing. The artwork has or renders the crew in and all the other characters in more conventional scale, so it doesn't bring the large head design over into the comic books. They are more regular human size.
It's more realistic in the comic book way of doing more realistic characters.
Absolutely. And of course, we've got this lovely artwork by Mike Noble, who features in the documentary on at least one of the DVD sets. And even on one episode of the comic was drawn by Dan Dare co-creator Frank Hampson. So that's, again, a very famous name in British comic history. Here he is doing an episode of Fireball XL5.
And this was in that wonderful era of the Century 21 comic, where, unlike the TV series, where you would have one Super Mario Nation show would run and then it would end, then the next one would run and it would end, and so on. There was only one at a time. You had all of them running at the same time in the comic books, and they were set up so that they were all part of the same world, and they would interact with each other. They would have things where characters from one series would show up on another and this sort of thing. And it was really quite neat in that, almost like the Marvel and DC comic book superhero universes, you had like a shared universe of the Super Mario Nation characters and storylines in comic book form. And that was really quite neat.
Yeah, it's lovely stuff. And they are available in some of the Gerry Anderson comics collections that we've talked about in the past. So you can find them. As well as the TV Century 21 comics, there were hardbacked annuals that ran from 63 to 66. Four in all. And there was also a single issue US comic from Gold Key Comics that came out in 1963. Just a single one, but there you can find that as well. Some of this early stuff, the toys, I know, are very well sought after, but you can find examples on the auction sites. They are out there. Or you can just go and marvel at the prices that people will now pay for them. Remarkable stuff, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, the theme song that we've mentioned, the closing theme song that was sung by Don Spencer, was released as a record. And in that sort of Space Mania kind of era, it made it to the charts. It did quite well. So that was that's sort of an interesting thing to see, too, that a theme song from a show like this could become a popular product of its own.
Yes, that Barry Gray song that is probably the piece of music you think of when you think of Fireball XL5. And as you say, a nice little hit record in its own right. And it's gone down into popular culture over the years. You may remember that shortly after Gerry Anderson's death, the writer Neil Gaiman sang the I Wish I Was a Spaceman theme tune with his wife's band, and you may have seen the video of that at the time in a rather sort of touching tribute to Gerry Anderson and his creations.
Yes, that's right.
Zodiac was on his way. Why haven't you cleared his takeoff?
We're waiting for moonrise, Commander Zero.
Hey, Commander, what have you done with the moon? It's overdue 10 minutes already. I want to get out to look for XL7. Over.
I know it's urgent, Steve, but something's gone haywire.
You better get the professor to make some quick calculations.
Okay, I'll wake him. What goes on? Are we on fire or something?
Anyone care for a cup of tea before we go?
Professor, for Pete's sake, we've got to work fast. XL7 has disappeared.
Yes, and so has the moon.
So we should get into some of our own thoughts about Fireball XL5, the good and the bad, if you will. We've dipped into that a little bit already, but we can get into it a little bit more. So, Eamon, what did you like about Fireball XL5?
Well, the good bits are trying to imagine yourself as a space-mad child of the early 60s watching this remarkable show at the time. And in that respect, I think, you know, there are some charming aspects to it. There's some wonderful model work, as ever, by Derek Medins and his team. And there's some wonderful monsters and puppets designed by Christine Glanville and her team. So the look and the images and some of the sort of adventures and creatures up on the screen, absolutely wonderful stuff to look at, I think.
Yes, I think this is a show that really needs to be looked at as a product of its time. And for that time, the visuals were really quite neat. You had some very good-looking things with spaceships, and the puppets walking around and speaking were still fairly new for that kind of look of puppets. And it was this big space show at a time where there were not, where not that much had been done yet. It was just starting to be a big thing to do shows that were always going out into space. So it really grabbed that and went with it, which was nice.
Yes, and some of the episodes are quite fun stuff. The writing perhaps varies, and I don't think it reaches the sort of more mature storylines we'll see in Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet and the Mistrons. But it, some of it is great stuff.
Yeah, there is some interesting stuff there. I think Barry Gray did a nice job with the soundtrack. It feels very much of its time, and it feels much like the Gerry Anderson style shows because he did so many of them. But I think it's quite a good soundtrack, and that closing theme is iconic, and I think it's really quite fun. I think it's nice to have that there.
Yes, I mean, if you do nothing else, at least go to YouTube and play the theme song, because it's marvelous stuff.
It is.
I suppose we've touched on already that it does have its limitations as a show. So we do have to say it is black and white, which may not be to everybody's taste. It is perhaps more childish than some of the other shows. We've mentioned some of the problems along the way with depictions of how, Dr. Venus and other female characters are treated, and maybe some unfortunate stereotyping of the other races that the 60s Britain and America were so suspicious of, I suppose.
Yes, there were certainly a lot of limitations with this. I'll say that the being in black and white really did not bother me at all. I think it looked pretty good in black and white. What bothered me more than that were the puppets at this stage, even compared to Thunderbirds, were fairly basic in a lot of ways. And in Thunderbirds, they had more than one face for each one. They had different facial expressions. Now, I think they may have just had two. They may have had like a smiling face for the comic moments and then a serious face the rest of the time. These ones for Fireball XL5 had a sort of smiling or half-smiling face all of the time. And it meant when we have these serious moments and the characters are in jeopardy and the actors are speaking very gravely and seriously, we have these sort of smiling faces, which I found a little bit odd and a little bit hard to watch.
Okay, so it's perhaps one of the more trickier Gerry Anderson shows to watch now. And, the two shows we've discussed before, Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet and the Mistrons, extremely successful. Secret Service we've covered, perhaps not quite so successful in its mixture of puppets and live action. And then this is an early show. I think this is it's a point along the development towards the height of Gerry Anderson and his Super Marionations shows.
Absolutely. And as a bit of that history, it's very interesting. And when we look at 1960s children's TV, and it's not that long ago that we talked about City Beneath the Sea and Secret Beneath the Sea series that were sort of early 60s children's shows, and the Pathfinders in Space series that was related to that we talked about some time ago. Those were all live action shows, but they have the sort of 1960s children's TV feel in common with this one. You know, the stories tend to be quite simple and childish, and they're not sort of reaching for more interesting ideas. And what you would get in even the first year or two at times of Doctor Who, and then in the Gerry Anderson shows in some episodes of things like Thunderbirds, and certainly in episodes of Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, you would get much more complicated and interesting things in children's TV, that you were sort of, you know, reaching up for something interesting rather than coming down to this sort of simpler level. So it's interesting to see where it sits, and I think this one, in terms of the writing and the voice work, definitely sits with that simpler era of things as they were before Doctor Who came out.
Okay, so it is a point on the graph, and it's on the way to bigger and better things, perhaps, then, Brian.
Yes. Something else to mention, when we talked about the Doctor Who comic books, actually just in our discussion previous to this one, we talked about the Dalek comic book series that appeared in Gerry Anderson's Century 21 magazine. And he talked about the idea that he really liked and sort of envied the Daleks as a sort of very effective robotic type creation, and something that in his puppet world, he was never able to do something that he felt was as strong as that. And I think it's Robert the Robot in Fireball XL5 that he was comparing to the Daleks, and sort of seeing that he wasn't satisfied with what he was doing there. And I can understand why. It was sort of quite a simple thing with Robert the Robot, and sort of not very sophisticated in many ways, but very interesting to see what they did and to see what their view of a robot was at that time.
I quite liked Robert the Robot.
Okay, fair enough.
I enjoyed him. I certainly could do it more of him and less of Zuni the Lazoon. But yes, it's interesting stuff, as you say. He's nearly always shown seated, the robot, actually sort of flying the ship or co-piloting the ship. So you don't see him up and moving about very often, which is probably just as well. And his strange steam-powered engine overheats, interesting. But I found him quite charming. I thought he was more successful, perhaps, than Gerry Anderson thought.
Oh, interesting. It is sort of definitely an interesting creation. Looking back at that character, he, I guess, mentally, you know, in terms of artificial intelligence, is not able to do very much. And that's something that I think in later things we saw robots being portrayed as smarter than that.
Yes, that's right. He can follow orders and he can get them home when he needs to, but that's about it.
Yeah, he can almost follow orders at times.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting to see what they did with that, for sure. And I'm guessing that Robert the Robot is a reference to Robbie the Robot from Forbidden Planet and other shows.
Yes, maybe. So I guess it's time for us to actually do our recommendations for our listeners about this show, and in particular the box sets that we've been looking at, and whether they should spend their hard-earned money on it. What do you think, Brian? How are you going to go on this one?
Okay, I can't really recommend this one. I suppose if you want to really get the history of some of the Super Marionation stuff, this will help give that to you and let you see a view of something that was being done in the 60s for children's TV. But apart from that, unless you're really focused on that, I can't recommend this one. I would have to say my recommendation would be to get Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons instead.
Okay, I think I'm going to agree with you there, Brian. It is a harder watch, this one, than the later Super Marionation shows. And as we've, I think, alluded to on several occasions, it's really a transitional show. Now, I've never seen a complete episode of Four Feather Falls or Supercar. I've only ever seen clips. And there's a huge gulf between them and Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet and the Mistrons. And somewhere in between is Firebolt XL5. And you can see that they are, you know, developing this stuff. They're getting better at it. But it's not yet at the height of their powers, I'm afraid. And it's a sizable box set. It's slightly more expensive than some of the shows we've been talking about. I think I'd agree with you. I'd say go and buy Captain Scarlet and the Mistrons first, or maybe spend your money on a rather remarkable documentary, which we've been looking at recently and talking about on the Facebook group, which is called Filmed in Super Mario Nation, a documentary that hopefully we'll get to talk about at some point. So maybe spend your money on that. There are some Fireball XL5 episodes up on YouTube, and although we don't normally recommend that, I'd probably say go and have a look at them there and see if it's up to your taste before spending your money. You have to be, I think, a particular fan of this show to want to go and get the box set.
Yes, maybe check out the opening and closing sequences with that lovely early 60s vocal at the end, and the opening with the launch sequence and the hover bikes and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anything with Barry Gray music, you want to check that out on YouTube because it's wonderful.
Very good. So, in summary, Fireball XL5 was an early black-and-white Super Mario Nation puppet show from Jerry Anderson that introduced us to Steve Zodiac and Venus, who were working for the World Space Patrol, and they went on regular missions along with a robot and a professor to deal with threats to Earth and to rescue other space travelers and to deal with various phenomena, and would always leave from Earth, go on this mission to go and take care of these various threats, and often detach Fireball Jr. and land with this detachable nose cone from the ship on alien planets, and would even use oxygen pills to go out into space with these thruster backpacks, and had lots of early 1960s style children's adventures from week to week.
Okay, and do come and join us in the Facebook group and tell us which is your favourite Jerry Anderson show, or join in the discussion that we're currently having about the Filmed in Super Mario Nation documentary.
Oh yes, absolutely.
And of course, please come and join us again next time when our two episodes will be looking at another Jerry Anderson show, our second for this year, but it's not Super Mario Nation, it's his only stop-motion animation show as far as we're aware. It's Dick Spanner PI, 1986 show, so something slightly different to talk about then.
Yeah, still in that sort of loosely animation kind of category, but definitely quite different from this one. And after that, we will be moving back to our regular live-action fare. In the meantime, find us at BritishInvaders.com, and please do join in our discussions on Facebook. If you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find our group there.
Or drop by the Voice of Geeks Network at VogNetwork.com, where you can listen to British Invaders on a Monday and a Tuesday, or stick around and listen to several other geek-related shows. A good place to come and join the community. Lots to be found at VogNetwork.com.
Yes, some lovely stuff there for sure. So thank you for listening. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England.
I wish I was a spaceman.
The fastest guy alive.
I'd fly you around.